Hello, and welcome back to Crackpot Theories, the podcast where everything is plausible until proven otherwise. I'm Sinead, and once again, this week, I have been joined by our lovely guest, Billy.
Hello!
And Billy, I hear you dragged somebody else into this mess.
I did. I dragged my partner in here. You can find him on TikTok under Hex Media, but it's my partner, Ian.
Very good to have you here, Ian. Now, the reason that you have been dragged into this is I hear that you're a big David Lynch fan.
I am indeed, yes.
Okay, excellent. What got you into David Lynch in the first place?
I love film and television, and believe it or not, my parents, growing up, we watched stuff that kids my age should definitely not have watched. like Twin Peaks when it aired, and I guess further along in my like collegiate studies, I did some film stuff and started to really enjoy David Lynch and his weird sort of esoteric symbolism and doesn't really give a crap what people think about what things mean. And it goes further than that, in terms of like music and his overall aesthetic and the actors he chooses and his decisions, but.
So he's just generally obsessed.
That's fair. If you're going to pick something to be obsessed by, there are considerably worse things to pick, really. But I think, as a David Lynch fan, I think one of the things you can really agree on is that if you're trying to make sense of what's going on, you're not really getting what it's about. You're missing the point.
Absolutely.
Great. But because this is Crackpot Theories, what we thrive on is we take the most ridiculous and the most outlandish theory out there and we make it make sense in context. But for David Lynch, we're going to have to kind of switch this and reverse it. We're going to choose something quite mundane and actually explain the plot of Mulholland Drive.
This feels so wrong.
It does.
This feels so wrong. We're inverting the whole process.
I know. It's Kat, will you stop trying to knock over my microphone? For God's sake. I'm sorry. My cat wants to be the fourth guest on this podcast and is knocking against the microphone and anything else she can find as well. Because apparently she has very strong opinions on the work of David Lynch. We are kind of going against nature very much here, in that I am going to endeavor to make Mulholland Drive make a lot of sense to people who are not necessarily David Lynch fans. Okay, I can kind of hear Ian's brain burning a little bit. Like, do you smell burnt toast?
A little bit, and some almonds, possibly.
Okay, so my base theory for Mulholland Drive is that the entire film that we are watching is taking place inside the brain of a person who is writing a novel. And this specific person is actually in the film. Her name is Coco. She is the landlady in the first story, which is the story with Betty, Rita, the Silencio Club. And then in the second story with Diane, Camilla, and the blue box and everything, she's Adam Kirscher's mother and is also still the landlady as well, I think. And she is writing this book. The first story is the first draft. And that's what I think writers usually refer to this as the vomit draft, which is, it's the draft that you write when you want to put in all the ideas that you're going to kind of refine a little bit later. So you just tap them all out and see what falls and see what kind of makes sense and looks good. And then she decides that actually, yeah, none of that makes sense. This is crap. I'd better write a different book. I'm just going to start again. And then the second story is the second draft of her book.
Okay, all right,
all right. Is he okay? Do you need to call somebody?
He's having a moment. I can hear the little hamster wheels squeaking in his brain. Give him a moment.
I think it's funny that you it's funny that you call this crackpot theories, because like if you had said that to me exactly how you said it before going in to watch the movie, it would make total sense. I will admit, first and foremost, And the last time I watched Mulholland Drive was about a year ago.
Okay.
And I made the unfortunate mistake of watching, like, 4 or 5 David Lynch movies in a row in one evening.
Ah, you had one of those.
It was a mess. It was a lot. I mean, I had watched all of them prior. It had been a little while, but Mulholland Drive accidentally kind of leaked into Lost Highway. They have nothing to do with one another. But loosely have a little to do with one another, because
if you try hard enough, you can make the connections. That's what we learned here.
Okay, great. End of the podcast, everybody. That was great. Perfect. You've explained it.
Okay, now I will go into a bit more detail as to why I came to this conclusion. Now, the background for me as well is that I really, you know, obviously because I have this podcast, I enjoy fan theories. So I enjoy listening to other people's fan theories as well. And I have watched 2 YouTube videos on theories that they had about Mulholland Drive where they tried to explain it. And then some of it was a bit convoluted. Some of it made sense. Some of them I felt like they were reaching even harder than I usually reach. But of course, it was all about the symbolism and, you know, this is the part that's taken place in a dream and this is the part that's reality. And I'm like, no. None of this is real. This is how it all makes sense. So to start with, I'm going to kind of tear apart their theory ever so slightly. Just one of them, really. But it's mostly to do with the fashion. And this is coming from kind of a personal place, because one of these... the guys that did this theory and tried to explain what was going on in Mulholland Drive is they tried to point out that Betty from the first series is quite a childish character, in that she's stuck in some sort of childhood. And a lot of this seemed based on what she was wearing, and that he pointed out that her clothes looked like they were too small for her. But having worn clothes in the late 1990s, I can tell you all of our clothes looked like that.
Nobody's clothes fit well then.
No, they were all really tiny. And you can see this in the things that Betty wears, is that she's got the tight little pencil skirts and the little spaghetti string tops. And the cardigan, like the very first cardigan you see her wearing, is super, super tiny. And it's got gaps in the buttons. And I mean, this guy, he labors that point quite clearly. And I'm like, no, she buttoned it up all the way. She wasn't supposed to do that. You're only supposed to button one of those buttons in the very center. The rest are just there for decoration. So no, it's a slight fashion faux pas. And that in itself is deliberate as well, because we want to say that, you know, in the vomit draft of this book, Betty is kind of gauche. She's not really a Hollywood type just yet. She's just a small town girl with big town dreams, stars in her eyes. She's wearing a cardigan that she's buttoned up all the way, even though it makes her look like a rube kind of thing. You know, it's just one of those little visual signifiers. It doesn't mean anything more than, you know, she's not really in key with the way the Hollywood does things yet.
It's funny you bring that specific detail up, because a couple of months ago, I sat down and watched Jawbreaker again for the first time in a long time.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, all those ladies are supposed to be playing high school girls, but they're all, I guess, in their 20s, and even some of them are in their 30s.
Yeah, they're like definitely deep into their mid-30s.
And I know the, you know, obviously it was, I think it was 2000 or 2001, so the you know, fashion of the 90s was still, no pun intended, fashionable.
Yeah.
But like, I kept thinking to myself, I'm like, I mean, are they just wearing clothes that don't fit them because they're trying to go with like high school girl fashion on like 20 and 30 something? Like, but no, that was just the style. Like,
it was late 90s to early 2000s was all this very, very tiny stuff, but also jeans that had these massive wide legs that trailed in the mud and got absolutely filthy. And
and then the
pencil skirts that were made of like rayon, and then the little pedal pushers and the big stacked heels as well. Like, it's all over the place in that film.
You're giving me wartime flashbacks right now.
I'm so sorry. I was a teenager at this point in time, so... Although I was an Irish teenager, so I think I escaped the worst of it. But anyway, so there's a couple of elements that remain the same in both stories. So when you're writing a piece of fiction, when you're doing the vomit draft, you put down the elements that you want to see, and then you go, okay, this is a load of shite. I'm going to delete all this, but I like this bit, this bit, this bit, and this bit. So I'm going to keep this in the second draft. So the look of the actresses, the basic look of them, Betty and Diane, played by the same actress, but they both have quite different looks. When she's a kind of, you know, a small town girl, she's got the little bob haircut. She doesn't have much hair gel in her hair, much product at all. She wears little barrettes, and she has the nice kind of small town clothes. In the second story, when she's Diane, her hair is spiky because she's wearing a lot of hair gel. You know, classic kind of up-and-coming actress who wants to be in the teen films type of look. For Rita and Camilla, their looks don't change that much from the vomit draft to the second draft, because in Coco's mind, that's the way she thinks that, you know, the ultimate glamour puss looks. And you can see that it's not that far off from how women back in Coco's heyday would have looked.
Yeah, right.
There's a whole thing about how Rita slash Camilla, they look quite like Rita Hayworth. She's got that real old Hollywood look to her. And of course, you know, there's a bit of a casting gag there, because Coco is played by Ann Miller, who was one of old Hollywood's absolute kind of character actresses. She was the girl that you drafted in to kind of class up the joint almost. So a lot of her contemporaries were the biggest stars at the time. She herself wasn't like a, you know, she wasn't necessarily a household name as such, but she was recognizable, and she always made a film better when she was in it. So you could see, like, she would have worked with a lot of the people who had that old style Hollywood glamour look. And also, she would have worked with some of the biggest bitches of the time.
Yep. For sure.
For sure.
Yeah. And, I mean, there's a lot of personality then in the kind of Betty, well, Betty and Diane, but mostly it's for Diane, is that she's playing kind of second fiddle to Rita. Or not Rita, Camilla. This is the second story. Is that Diana has been forced into a part where she's playing second fiddle to Camilla, because Camilla is sleeping her way to the top. And yeah, that's a bit of flavor that you can add to a story. But this is also possibly something that might have happened to Coco back when she was a Hollywood star, because it's definitely something that happened to Ann Miller. But then Coco's presence is kind of constant, because she always wants to have the cameo, but her role in the vomit draft and then her role in the second draft are very different. First, she's just the landlady. She pops in for a couple of seconds. Second draft, she says, actually, I want more of a presence in this. I'm going to make myself the director's mom. Joke. Just for the crack. You know? Other elements that remain the same in the first and the second draft is somebody getting a hit taken out on them. In the first draft, it's a failed hit, and then it leads to the whole insomnia, you know, going to a club, this mysterious thing going on, and also that really weird failed hit. Now, the failed hit in the vomit draft, where the hitman goes and he tries to murder this one guy, and it ends up going absolutely balls up, really. And
really poorly.
Yeah, where he has to kill a whole bunch of other people. I mean, that strikes me as the kind of very implausible story that might actually have happened. You know, it's one of those old Hollywood stories where, you know, well, somebody took a hit out on somebody else, but it went horribly wrong, so they had to cover it up kind of thing. It's like the kind of story you'd hear on the likes of You Must Remember This, or or Blind Items, you know, that kind of way, where, you know, maybe it was a bit of behind-the-scenes gossip, maybe it actually happened. But it makes for a very good story. So she popped it into the vomit draft just for a bit of flavor. Okay, is this making sense so far?
Yes. Actually, yes.
Wonderful.
Which is really weird to say about anything David Lynch. Because normally Ian's the one trying to explain to me what the heck is happening. Because I like logic. And you can't follow logic with David Lynch. So this is interesting.
Okay, beautiful. And, well, strap in. It's only going to get more normal from here.
Let's get weird.
So, yeah. what we can also kind of pin this down is when you're looking at it from Coco's perspective, Coco coming of age in a time of great glamour. So you have this kind of weird thing, which I think is a bit of a David Lynch staple, where it seems like it takes place in two different time periods simultaneously. You have the look of the late 90s, but then you have also the look of the late 50s, early 60s. And they're kind of meshed into one. That makes sense for Coco, because she's looking at the way people look now while she's writing the book, while also recalling the way people looked when she was at her height in old Hollywood.
Absolutely. The hair. Oh, the hair. I love the soft waves that you see. And it's not just the main actresses in the movie either. It's people in the background look stupidly glamorous for no reason.
Absolutely.
You have no reason to look this good and be like a quarter of a face in a bar in the middle of the night.
Yes. And then there's also a thing with Rita / Camilla, is that she looks timeless the entire way through. So it's almost like she's kind of almost set up to be like this, well, they start off in the vomit draft, she's kind of like this real ethereal angel who came to Earth and has no memory, and Betty has to look after her, and she's just so beautiful and completely timeless. And then in the second draft, she's a complete and utter succubus. But she still has that kind of inhuman glamour, and that's what she wanted to get across there, is that this character is beautiful and timeless and seems out of place and is just this object of worship for Betty / Diane. Now, the only thing is that in the vomit draft, she wanted to keep Betty on the same level, but then she realized that that dichotomy doesn't work very well. If you make Betty on the same level as Camilla, or sorry, as Rita, I'm going to get confused with these names now. Okay, first story we have Betty and Rita, and Betty and Rita, they're kind of on the same level. Camilla is beautiful and ethereal and old-style glamorous and just doesn't seem like she's real. And Betty is just like this real cherubic angel who's a natural actress who's not going to get a fair shake because everything's up against her, you know? And then Coco realized this is very hackneyed. There's no drama here, really. And nobody's going to like Betty because they're going to think that she's too good. She is, to use the phrasing of fandom, she is a Mary Sue. And
it's not realistic whatsoever, honestly.
Yeah, so she had to make grittier. She had to make kind of dirtier. It's entirely possible that between the vomit draft and the second draft, she went off and she read like a James Ellroy book. And then realized, actually, yeah, this is a lot more compelling than the shite I was writing. I'm going to have to make, Betty a little bit messed up. And in fact, Betty is not a good name to give her. That's an old school name. What's a more modern name? Diane. So she decided to call her Diane, messed her image up a little bit. And like the difference then between like Betty is so clean cut in the vomit draft. And Diane is so kind of, she looks like she hasn't slept in a couple of days. She looks like she mightn't have showered lately. She's still gorgeous, but she looks a bit roughed up. You know?
Yeah, like she's been through something.
Yeah, and it's, you can almost see it as being a kind of a description in a book. When I read the book, They Shoot Horses, Don't They? And they described the woman that would then be played in the film by Jane Fonda. And they were just like, you know, she had that kind of old style Hollywood glamour, but she was just a little bit too rough around the edges. She looked like she hadn't slept in a while. She had lines around her mouth from all the smoking she was doing. And they went into this long, lengthy description of how she wasn't beautiful anymore, even though she obviously had been. And it's the kind of description you can almost hear line by line in your head while you're looking at Diane. I'm just going to pause to let that sink in a little bit. Yeah. So other things that remain the same is the director is he's married to somebody, but it's somebody who's cheating on him. They get a scene in the vomit draft and a cameo with Billy Ray Cyrus, because why not? And I mean, that is a thing that has happened in other novels where they write a person and they write a very long detailed description but don't use the actual name. And it's left to the person reading the book to go, oh, that's obviously Paris Hilton or something like that they're writing
about. It forces them to put themselves in the story.
Exactly. But then they decided they didn't like that scene. They're going to cut it out and they're going to move that entire character just to, well, I was married, but now I'm not. So now I'm going to marry Camilla because Camilla has got her talons into me now at this stage, kind of thing. The vomit draft, she was able to cut so much out of that that just, it was only there for flavor. Maybe she'll add it in somewhere else. We don't know, because as far as I'm concerned, although the film of Mulholland Drive is finished, she could still be writing this book. She's not finished writing it yet. It's unfinished. From where we left off?
Yeah, whatever. We were just chittering on over here being like, well, now we gotta watch the goddamn movie again. Now we have to like sit there and be like, yes, it is some crazy old lady writing a book and then saying, fuck this, and then writing the book again.
Rolling over in my head because like, it's almost like two completely different movies when you watch it, just with similar events. So when you're using the different names, I'm like, oh, right, no, she's from part two, even though she's the same.
Yeah, but David Lynch does that shit on purpose. To confuse the ever-living hell out of you.
Okay, so before we had our technical difficulties, what was the last thing you remember me saying?
Oh god, I don't know. Ian's better at remembering things than I am.
No, that's fair enough. Listen, we'll just go from my notes there anyway. Unfortunately, sometimes living in rural Ireland means that your internet decides to randomly shut off while you're right in the middle of doing something.
Okay.
So
we figured as much. I was like, I wonder if her connection just decided to say, I'm done.
Yeah, you see, they don't expect people to be up at this hour. It's 2:20 in the morning here. Yeah. Okay, so...
You need to go to bed.
No, I don't. That is for tomorrow, the writing. I need to be doing exactly what I'm doing right here. Okay, so, yeah, I think the last thing that I said was that Coco, she wants to be in the book. She doesn't want to have a massive presence in the book, but she wants to have a little kind of Alfred Hitchcock-style cameo.
She wants the credit. She wants a little bit of screen time.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong.
Exactly. And the funny thing is, the way that she talks is still the old school Hollywood way that she would have talked back in the day when she tells Betty.
She has like a mid-Atlantic accent almost.
Yeah, it's like, you're telling me a lot of horse pucky kind of thing.
Oh god, you're so cute.
Thank you. But anyway, yeah, so she decided that in the second draft she wanted to give herself a slightly bigger... part to it, and also then because Adam is her son in the second part, she wants to make things good for him, so he's getting married to this beautiful, possibly evil woman. You know, because in the first book she's, you know, Rita's a bit like, but I'm so innocent and sweet and so ethereally gorgeous, why would anybody want to kill me? And then in the second one she's like, it's just the evil smolder all over the place. Yeah. And then, of course, the whole thing with Melissa George, and I, like, anytime I see Melissa George in anything, I always remember her from Home and Away, because I used to watch that fairly often when I was younger, and she was one of the main characters in that.
That's a throwback.
Isn't it just? Yeah. She was one of the big characters in it, and she's been in a couple of kind of Hollywood films, but first time I saw Mulholland Drive, I didn't recognize her. And then the next time, now that I know it's Melissa George, I cannot help but see her as Angel from Home and Away. And it's kind of jarring. But in that way, I'm going to compare this to a book that was, I don't know if you might have heard of it, because it was written by an Irish author. It's called Only Ever Yours, I think it was. And the author, obviously... She was writing about a lot of very beautiful women for the sake of the book. The book was kind of like it was kind of like a cross between The Handmaid's Tale and something like Soylent Green.
Oh, creepy. All right.
Yeah, it was. It was a really, really good book. But when she was writing it, she had very, you could see it, that she had very clear ideas in mind what all of these girls looked like. And it was reflected in their names, because the main character was named Frida and was modeled to look like Frida Pinto, the actress. And the kind of the evil girl in it was called Megan. So Megan Fox.
Okay.
Yeah, and then of course she came from the same generation I did, so like one of the other characters, Isabel, and she was modeled to look like Isabel Lucas, who was also in Home and Away. So you see the little strands, they join up in weird ways. Anyway, back to Melissa George. But you can kind of see what this is, that Coco saw an actress and wanted to put her in the book. If it was a film, she would have put her in the film. Or maybe she had ideas that this was going to be optioned as a film because this book would be so amazing. And that she could say, I have the perfect person in mind to play this character. Melissa George. You know her. She was on Home and Away. She was brilliant in that kind of thing. Yeah, so that's the kind of the more normal stuff. But then the weird stuff. We've got the part with the man explaining about the hobo monster behind the diner.
It's like one of the infamous top 10 scenes from a movie that aren't horror that scared you, you know, like,
yeah. And you know, I don't even think it's that scary. Like, it's like, it's a jump scare, but if you're used to jump scares, you're like, oh, it's a hobo, oh no, your man looks, yeah, like he's had a heart attack, is he okay?
The scene early on, or I think somewhere near the center of the film, where they come across the corpse in the apartment, was far more frightening, far more jarring. The whole like living nightmare thing, I mean, that's kind of David Lynch's MO, right? Is like pretending that he's dreaming while he's awake and all that kind of stuff, and like nightmares and dreams are no different from one another. So like the whole scene where he's explaining, you know, oh yeah, this crazy hobo monster behind the dumpster, and then he just often breaks away and goes and like just lives it, it's just like, what in the hell is going on?
True, but you know, if you explain this away by using a book, is that this was a scene that was meant to be important, that she was going to explain that the cop has some sort of psychic powers, and that the guy behind the diner, he's got some sort of overarching plot. He's like the antithesis to Rita's character. She's the ultimate of beauty and innocent, and this diner hobo is the ultimate evil. And that they're going to have some sort of epic battle. And then she realized that's a terrible idea. And it just went nowhere. And crossed the entire thing out. So it's just kind of floating there. And she doesn't really do anything with it. It's one of those scenes that just goes nowhere if it's in a book. And then the thing about the mobsters and them hating the espresso. You know, and them trying desperately to get coffee that's going to impress them, and them just going, yeah, no, not having any of this coffee, this is terrible. And them having a really kind of not normal reaction to being told who's allowed in the book. And then, of course, you get the cut to the guy who's played by the dwarf from Twin Peaks, but he's in a normal-sized man suit. Yeah, like all of that could be just based on kind of rumors or little ideas that Coco had while she was thinking about this, that she was going to do something with. She was going to make it important later, but she was just trying to set up some sort of foreshadowing for the future, that, you know, somebody was going to do something with coffee, like coffee was going to ultimately take down the mobsters. But then she realized she had no way to join up those clues, so off the vomit draft it went.
Okay.
Yeah. Then there's the cowboy enforcer, which is probably my favorite scene in the entire film, is where your man comes up and he doesn't take the cowboy seriously. And the cowboy's just like, you're going to be a smartass and I'm going to kill you because you're just not being sensible, man. And he just says it in such a nonchalant way, and he's a cowboy and he's just kind of out of place. But could you imagine, like, you know, in real life, the most successful hitmen are the ones that blend into the background. You know, they're the ones that you can't pick out of a crowd. That's why they're so successful. Same with serial killers. The less ostentatious you are, the less likely you're going to get caught. But that doesn't work for a book. You have to make them notable. For, you know, if you compare it to something like No Country for Old Men.
Mm.
And your man, Anton Chigurh, who is just the weirdest person. And on purpose, because if he was just like, do you remember that documentary, The Iceman, I think it was?
Yeah, I was about to say, yeah. What's Krasinski? What's his name?
Yes, something like that. Or even like the Australian versions, like The Chopper. I mean, yeah, he was a very larger-than-life character. But like, you know, these are two relatively normal guys. And that's why they got away with their crimes for so long. Chopper, of course, is not a normal person anymore. He's more like a walking caricature. But that's because he kind of bought into his own mythos. So in order to make this an interesting thing for a book, you have to add some flavor. So, you know, Ann Miller comes from the days when cowboy films were a big deal. And...
I'm going to say that.
Yeah. And, you know, you could imagine that maybe Coco always wanted to be in a Western, but never got the chance.
This is her time to shine.
Yeah, and I mean, you could say, like, if you were writing this as a sentence in a book, it's like, the cowboy, he bore an awful resemblance to John Wayne, but younger, and less worn out over time, kind of thing.
And less tan.
Yeah, it's just like, he pinned Adam down with an icy glare. You're going to be a smartass, aren't you? It's all this kind of dialogue. You can almost hear it being written as you're watching the film. But then she realized that that was a terrible idea too, so she didn't do it again. But she did like the idea of the cowboy. So that's why the cowboy appears in the second draft. But not doing the same thing. Yeah.
You're breaking him. You're breaking him. He's literally over here going, yeah. And just like staring off into space, yeah.
Oh God. Well, this is the ultimate result. We do like to blow people's minds and then recalibrate them to make sense with our own world vision. Eventually I will start a cult and...
I will join you.
You must turn over all your worldly possessions to me. But anyway, yeah, like all of these are ideas that seem like they're great until you write them out and you realize that they don't make any sense.
Utter garbage.
And even then the scene, like the scene with the club. Now, the scene with the club, I'm going to draw a parallel to a scene in the Wicked novel. For obvious reasons, it never made its way to the stage musical because... Nope. It came out of nowhere. It was really weird and really disturbing. And when you're reading the book, it's one of the things you kind of remember and go, Jesus Christ, what was that? Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it all took place in a club. I'm not going to talk much more about that because otherwise I would have to rate this podcast 18 plus.
Yep.
Do you know what I'm talking about?
I read Wicked before I saw the stage play. So last time I read Wicked, I was 15. So it has been 15 years. Remind my poor melty brain.
There is a scene with two minor characters in a club and a tiger.
Yes. Moving on!
Yeah, but you know, the whole thing with the Club Silencio, you know, you get the MC who acts like he's come from cabaret.
Mm-hmm.
And you get Rebecca Del Rio who comes in, sings that absolutely beautiful song, and then it turns out she's not singing at all. And the two girls have their freak out. Again, all of this seems real evocative when you're playing it in your mind, and it's real evocative when it's on the film. But if you wrote this down on paper, you'd take one look at it and go, yeah, this isn't working. I'm going to have to cut this entire scene. So off it goes. Another part of the vomit draft has been just ripped out.
Something just popped into my head.
Okay.
That similar... it's in, I want to say... Yeah, it's in Blue Velvet.
Ah.
Where they... The one scene where they go back to... What's-His-Face's house?
Jeffrey? And,
what, say again?
Was it Jeffrey's house?
I think so. What's his face? Who plays the villain in it?
Oh, Frank.
Frank, yeah, Frank, there you go. They go back to Frank's house and they put on that, like, there's like an MC and they have a stage and they put on a production and he has like his lamp that looks like he was working on a construction site. And it's a very, David Lynch loves, I've read a lot about when he talks about like when he uses curtains and what curtains mean. And why he has, why the, like the set dressing for the Black Lodge and all that kind of stuff have curtains as backdrops. And there's a fair amount of talk on his end, actually, explaining why he uses specifically like red curtains, like in the Club Silencio and in Mulholland Drive. I don't think there are curtains much in Blue Velvet, which is funny because Blue Velvet's the whole thing about, you know, like the blue velvet curtain and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But I remember like watching the two back to back again, like a year or so ago, and being like, wait a minute, that even the MC in Silencio, if I remember correctly, looks kind of similar to the quote-unquote MC in Blue Velvet. And me being like, wait, okay. are we walking in on a production in a completely different universe, but it's like guided by the same dude?
Yeah, do you know, the thing I think with David Lynch is David Lynch does not do vomit drafts at all. It's not in his vocabulary. Everything that he puts down is eventually put into the film, and he makes it work.
It's an extended acid trip.
Yeah, exactly. But you see, he sets out to be surrealist. Coco is trying to write a gritty novel that people would actually read and is failing miserably.
Poor woman.
She's doing her best, God bless her. But, you know, it was kind of like after Christina Crawford wrote Mommy Dearest. And then all of the Hollywood kids came out with their own exposés of their terrible parents. Some of them were true to life and some of them weren't. But it's just like, you know, she sees kind of people who lived in Hollywood at the time writing these great novels that were then turned into great films. And she wants a bit of that for herself. But she's no idea how to go about it. So she's just trying to kind of almost ape things that she's seen done in other books and done in other films. So this is why her vomit draft and her second draft are so different, yet also so similar.
It's like the first one's just a continual stream of consciousness of what she thinks might work. The second one is a refined version of things that she knows will work.
Yeah, and it's also grittier. So because people like gritty novels, kind of, I think there's a real thing that, you know, the franchises, when you watch them go up in popularity, is when Harry Potter ended, Twilight was the big thing. And then after Twilight was the big thing, The Hunger Games was the big thing. And they just kind of got progressively grittier over time. And then the likes of, you know, Divergent and Mortal Instruments and all of those tried to come along and do something similar. But there's like, you haven't made it different enough for it to make an impact. You know? And that's kind of, Coco wants to write Hunger Games, but she's writing Divergent instead.
I want that tattooed on my arm. She wanted to write this, but she wrote something so horrible instead.
Listen, I've never read Divergent. I'm sure it's a perfectly fine book. I did read Hunger Games, though, and I was satisfied with Hunger Games. So I didn't feel the need to read something that was that similar to it.
I don't know. Me and Hunger Games are not friends.
That's absolutely fair.
We're just not. When you're forced to read a teen novel when you're in college for your undergrad, it makes you loathe it for the rest of your life.
That's fair. Do you know, I never watched Twilight, or I never read Twilight when it was big, and I never watched the films, and I only watched them recently now. And Jesus Christ, first of all, it is one load of shite.
And, oh, yes.
And secondly, it did not age well.
I am so proud of you for still having your eyeballs firmly set in your head, because I would have plucked my own out if I had to watch that movie again, or any of them, because they're god-awful. They're so bad.
I think, you know, I will say that my lifetime fandom for extreme horror films has really saved me in that respect, because I have seen a lot of things and laughed. And so Twilight was by far, like, the worst I can say about it. It was boring. It bored me.
I had a big problem with the terrible makeup job on literally everyone, and also whoever their costume, or if you could even call it that, costume designer is, needs to go fall in a ditch.
The only thing I really liked about it was the fact that Robert Pattinson just hated being in it, and you can tell because he just plays the part with so much contempt, and I'm so proud of him.
No, I was going to say, I feel like Kristen Stewart reads all of her lines through gritted teeth.
Yes.
Like, I don't think she knows how to move her lips to say anything. She's almost like, oh God, what? My sister is a total smartass. She said something about Kristen Stewart being the weirdest version of a ventriloquist dummy she's ever seen. Like the Hollywood version of a ventriloquist dummy. She's like, why does she look like she's throwing her voice, but there's nowhere to throw it to? So she just mumbles it instead.
Yeah, do you know, she's kind of the classic example of that person who has to take whatever role is given to her until she can actually pick and choose her own projects to be in. She looks so much happier now.
Yeah, here's the problem with her in general. She's actually a pretty good actress.
Yeah.
That just was not her role. Teen vampire drama was not her shtick, and they shoved her into an entire series of it. I feel awful for the entire cast for having to sit through that for, what was it, like something crazy, like over the span of 6 years of filming, editing, and releasing this nonsense. Like, that's like a black mark on your IMDb.
Absolutely.
Like, I did this and this and this acclaimed work. Oh yeah, and Twilight. And then they just put their heads down. Shame. For shame. And the books look like the author slammed her face into a keyboard a few times and then was like, oh my God, I'm a bestseller.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can't get behind Twilight. I had to read that one during my undergrad as well. And I can tell you, I will read Hunger Games front to back 12 times before I even crack open a Twilight ever again.
That's absolutely fair. I mean, I will say just one more thing kind of about Robert Pattinson is that he was really, really good in The Lighthouse. Like,
yes. Yeah. We have not watched The Lighthouse yet. We've been meaning to.
Oh, it's great crack. It is great crack.
He was so good in Water for Elephants.
Yeah, he was decent in that. That wasn't, you know, it's not the kind of film that I would normally think about more than twice. But I love kind of weird horror films. So him being in The Lighthouse, you could just tell he'd kind of, you know, he'd seen some stuff. And so he was able to throw himself really fully into that role. But this, I think, in its own way, ties back into our theory about, you know, Coco's problem is that she's too self-aware when she's writing this book. Because she wrote a vomit draft. And she wasn't happy with it. So she took the elements she liked and put it in her second draft. And then she looked at that and she didn't really like that either. So she never finished it. And I think the whole thing when it ends with the woman saying silencio and the film ending is Coco has decided to give up trying to be a writer. She never went back to it. People like Stephanie Meyer don't give up that easily. And that's why their projects get made.
That's a really nice way of putting it.
Yeah, but you know, again, Coco is kind of aware of what makes a good project and what makes a bad project. I mean, she obviously has some fair acting know-how because she's able to do the scene in the vomit draft where Betty is kind of reading the lines off the page and doing a terrible job of it and just laughing at how corny the lines are. And then when she comes to actually do the scene, she's brilliant. You know, that's something that Coco has knowledge of because she's either done it or she's witnessed it, you know. So that's a scene that she actually managed to write well, and then it's actually a shame that she never brought it over into her second draft because that could have made it work. The most we get really is kind of Diane watching Camilla in the car acting out the scene and realizing that Camilla has screwed her over so badly. You know, because again, that's something that probably Coco experienced or witnessed herself. So she's able to write those two scenes absolutely amazingly. It's just the rest of the book that she's having issues with. Now, here's another little point. You know the way David Lynch likes to leave the camera running? Yeah. So there's a lot of focus on inanimate objects. And I think in the early DVD release, it came with a booklet that said, look out for this, 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 and this. And a lot of these things on the list was objects. So you've got the blue box, you've got the key, the lamps, the ashtray, and the camera just focuses in on them for a very long time, amount of time that in a regular film, you'd see it once and then it'd be gone. But he really hyper-focuses in on it. That's because that time span that you're spent looking at this thing is the length of time that it'll take you to read a descriptive passage of this object and why it's important. So it's like a, you know, kind of thing like, Diane looked at the ashtray. It was in the shape of a piano. Her ex-girlfriend had left it behind there. They won it in Las Vegas in a stupid competition. It was really tacky and it didn't go with anything else in the house, but Diane liked to keep it around, just for old time's sake.
And then the scene moves on.
We have to find a copy of this. We have to find a copy of this right now.
You could write the entire thing out as a novel, and it would read sensibly.
We have to get a DVD copy of this shit. Oh, crap. Well, we had a copy of the movie the whole time. Shows you how much I know about my own house.
Well, I have a copy of a VHS copy of
the movie. Oh, beautiful. I'm sure you can find all this stuff online. I mean, obviously, there's people out there, and these people have also been very big Dave Lynch fans and have categorized absolutely every single second of that film. But maybe if you put all of those things together and write every scene in that film as if it was a book, you would have two distinct books, one that doesn't make a huge amount of sense, one that makes a lot more sense, but also doesn't have a lot happening in it. Because the second half of the film isn't really as interesting as the first half. The vomit draft is always more interesting than the refined draft. It's just that the refined draft doesn't have all these ridiculous leaps in logic and plot points that go nowhere.
This is why I need the DVD, so I can just keep rewinding little parts over and over again, thinking about what you're saying to me right now.
Well, yeah.
And making it work.
I think that there was
I love this. I would have never thought of any of this until you had said this. And my brain now, I'm not a huge David Lynch fan. I appreciate his work. It's nothing like Ian, who's madly obsessed. But, like, now you're just completely breaking my brain, too. In the best way possible.
Well, that is a beautiful experience that I have now shared with you. This is Crackpot Theories, breaking brains one at a time. Now, the club scene, actually, I'm going back to my notes because I've gone off the notes for quite a long tangent there. But going back to the club scene, interesting things happen to you in clubs when you've been drinking, or when you've been doing things that you weren't really supposed to be doing. But, I mean, there's a thing with Hollywood that in order to keep their actresses and their actors looking a certain way, that they'd pump them full of uppers and downers and have them on these crazy exercise regimes. Purposefully having them dehydrated to make their muscles stand out more. Actually, a scene in the musical Kiss Me, Kate, where Ann Miller is doing the song Too Darn Hot. And if you go and watch that scene, you know, she does an absolutely amazing job. She tap dances on a table. She's got this big, beautiful Hollywood smile. She did that entire scene with a broken rib.
It's called the Judy Garland diet.
Mm.
It's terrible. They did that to, who else was it? Is Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland, and used to make them perform on uppers, downers, cigarettes, liquids, broken ankles. Mickey Rooney had a lifelong partial limp because they made him work on a broken knee. So, like, that's terrible.
Yeah.
But yeah, we've done the same thing. Ian and I are both performers, and we've both performed under horrible circumstances multiple times, and it is not a good time.
Oh, listen, there was a time that I did stand-up after I had lost my voice, and I spent 3 hours trying to get it back by drinking quite a lot of whiskey. I don't remember being on stage.
Oh, boy.
Apparently, I was hilarious.
I've been there, unfortunately, too many times. I had a friend who broke a rib, and then a week later we had another show, and he was letting it set, and he was rehearsing for the same act in a different show, and he broke the same rib again. And we had to finish this two-hour performance. Funny enough, at a funeral home.
Oh god.
We perform in weird places, okay? And also, you had a friend who had, like, what, a dental abscess, and she was, like, trying to fix it by swishing whiskey?
Well, it actually was brandy, and that was only for a few hours because we had a show that night, and then it was the next day. It was like, yeah, all right, let's just go get your...
I love how you're like, it's only for a few hours. No normal person does that.
Well, yeah, I think this is kind of part and parcel of what we're talking about, really, is that this is the kind of thing that separates the wannabes from the true artists. Is that an artist will work through their pain, whether it's advised or not, and they will find ways to do it. But I mean, part and parcel of old Hollywood as well is having to attend parties and go to clubs in order to accompany somebody. So that whole thing with Club Silencio, you know, might have been something that Coco kind of barely remembers, but she doesn't remember it right because of what she was on at the time. You know? I mean, certain performances can seem absolutely terrifying when you're under the influence of certain substances. You know, and she wanted to kind of portray that in a very alienating, very scary way, because that's how she felt at the time witnessing this. It might have been, like, when she saw it, it might have been a completely normal performance, but it seemed like the music was, first of all, coming from the singer, and then the singer went away and the music continued. It's maybe she had like a 5-second brain lag that made that seem like that's what was happening. And she wanted to portray this in such a way in her vomit draft, but also didn't know what to do with it.
Yeah, it makes me wonder. David Lynch does that kind of often, right? He has these like really crazy, weird, awkward party scenes. I'm just thinking about a Firewalk With Me, like the Twin Peaks movie.
Yeah.
There's this like 10-minute long scene in the pink room in the back of the R&R where it's like people are just like having sex and taking drugs and all this kind of stuff, and it's so loud you can't hear what anybody's saying, and it just sort of floats, like it plateaus for 10 straight minutes. But the viewer, at least in my experience, I was like, I'm really uncomfortable. Like I've been in these situations before, but just watching it from the outside, it's just so uncomfortable, and just your anxiety continues to, you know, grow and grow and grow. And then, of course, the scene eventually ends, and I'm pretty sure somebody dies or someone ends up dead. I can't remember. I've watched it in a few years, but yeah, he does that a lot, and I wonder why. What maybe in like his history it makes him want to write that sort of thing.
Well, I mean, I'd say David Lynch has had to attend a lot of parties that he didn't want to go to. And that when you're doing something that you don't particularly want to, after you recall it, the recollection gets different every time you recall it. So it becomes worse, or it becomes weirder every time you do recall it. And because this is David Lynch, you know, he hyper-focuses on certain aspects of it so that they become more visually important and more visually present when he recalls it on film. And I think... in its own way, Coco was doing similar in that this is probably a fairly normal club. They might have had some technical difficulties, but because of the state that she was in at the time and because of just how she's recollecting it, because obviously I'd say this Club Silencio thing happened many, many years before, and she's recalling this as an older woman. So it's gotten very different in her head. You know, so that's how I make that scene make sense, is this is all being told from the point of view of somebody who is not in necessarily full possession of the facts and who is recalling things through the filter of nostalgia.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, that's her experience with it. Everybody else around her may be having a perfectly fine time, but it sounds like she wasn't.
Well, do you know what's a really horrible feeling, and I think everybody has this, is when you have a favorite piece of media and you want to show it to somebody, and you show it to them and they don't laugh and they just sit there watching it and kind of nodding along, and you love this thing that you're showing them. Mm-hmm. You watch it all the time. It's one of your favorite things ever. But now you're seeing it through their eyes and you're like, was it always this crappy? Were the production values always this bad? Was it always this boring? And of course, it's not any of those things, because this is one of your favorite things. It's just that you're seeing it differently because you're seeing it with the filter removed.
So funny enough, just to relate back to David Lynch, but there have been several occasions where I've had people watch like the first episode of Twin Peaks, or I've sat down and watched like the first season. And this happened to me on a couple of, like, you know, five or six times where I've done this with other people.
Yeah.
And they're, I think, like the third or fourth time, I remember sitting down and being like, I think I'm going to try and watch who's watching more than I'm going to watch it. You know what I mean? Because I'm like, it's already 30 years old. And I always tell people, like, if it feels a little awkward, that's because it is, and that's on purpose. And then I'll just kind of sit back and I'll be like, you know, this almost feels like it's bad. What, is it done poorly? Is that the point? And then I'm like, yeah, it's the point. They're going to hate it. or I'm going to love it, or whatever. You know?
Well, fun fact, because we were in lockdown, myself and my father, we decided that we were going to watch Twin Peaks, because I said to him, just give it a chance. You might find things that you like about it. Now, I wasn't expecting him to last past maybe 3 episodes. Not only did he watch the entire series, but then we watched The Return. And, like, this is my father. My father does not, like, he's a fairly standard man, like, middle-aged man. He does not like modern art or experimental music or anything like that, or even sometimes mildly spicy food. He's just not that kind of person. But he watched every minute of The Return, even episode 8 with the firemen and the egg and the Bob and the insect crawling out of the egg into the girl's mouth. He watched every minute of that, and he actually enjoyed it. And it was kind of amazing, because I was not expecting that at all. So it's like I had the opposite reaction with him than I do when I usually show other things to other people. But it's kind of like, then that also makes me wonder, did Coco show any of these drafts to people and realize while that person was reading it that the plot made no sense?
No, I don't think so.
Are we, the viewers of the movie, are we the proofreaders?
We could be trying to make edits every time we rewind or look at a scene a little bit closer. It's like, I liked what you did with this, but it went nowhere. Can you explain it a bit more? Or even the fact that we're making theories about it is we're just trying to make sense of the draft that she delivered to us, and trying to, because she's a nice old lady and we want her to be happy. So we want her to get her book published and then maybe turned into a movie. But we don't have the heart to tell her, this doesn't make any sense. I think she should go back and write this part, and this part again. This part was cool, though.
Can I offer an alternative crackpot theory?
Yes, absolutely.
Think of this as almost like Blair Witch Project level nonsense, which is, what if, like, we found this in a library?
Oh.
Just chilling. And we're just reading it for the first time and getting to know her through her writing. I don't think she had proofreaders. I don't think she did, because she has too much pride.
Maybe so,
way too much,
yeah,
pride. If she's taking her golden age era, you know, silver screen thought process seriously, which it sounds like she is because she loves the idea of being a glamour queen, she's putting her heart and soul into this, and her ideas, and the idea of somebody turning it down and not thinking it's good enough tells me she hasn't shown anyone this, only evidenced by the fact that there are 2 drafts.
I mean, it could be one of those kind of lost footage type things where I think they did this as a plot point in BoJack Horseman, where this guy...
We love BoJack Horseman.
Wonderful. Well, do you remember when Herb Kazaz wrote his book, and it was going to be his magnum opus, and then he died, and his nurse,
yes,
destroyed it because she said, I read it, it was shite, and I don't want to taint his legacy like this, so I'm just going to burn it. Do you know, it could be something like that maybe years after the actress that wrote the book died, and Ann Miller has passed on now at this stage. Now, it's not necessarily Ann Miller that wrote this. That's a little too crackpot even for me. But, you know, the actress that wrote this, she passed away without finishing the manuscript. So maybe as time goes on, and the same way that, you know, we had Twin Peaks The Return, maybe there'll be an add-on to Mulholland Drive that's been written by somebody else, by a ghostwriter.
Like a Truman Capote kind of scenario.
Yeah, exactly. Or your man who wrote Dune, and then his child wrote Dune afterwards, and they made about as much sense when his son wrote them as they did when his dad wrote them. Feckin' Dune. I am one of the few people that liked David Lynch's version of Dune.
I was just about to say, I was like, well, not to, you know, make more reference to David Lynch, but I love the David Lynch movie.
Listen, it made as much sense to me as the book did. And I tried very hard with that book. Yeah. It wasn't happening. It just wasn't happening. I was in tears by the end of it.
You tried, though.
It is. Do you know, here, listen, maybe, you know, Frank Herbert was the pseudonym of this old Hollywood actress, and Mulholland Drive was the thing that she tried to write before she gave it up and wrote Dune.
Right.
Okay, yeah.
It's not Ann Miller, it's Stacey Miller. Daughter, granddaughter.
Okay, I think we're coming up to the end mark, and that includes the time taken away for the technical difficulties that we had. How are you guys feeling?
Mind blown slightly, and now I have to go watch it again.
I can hear the little keyboard clacks in my head trying to write this out myself, but like, even, you know, thinking about it, like in terms of like plot A all the way to the end of the movie, it makes sense. Like, it doesn't sound crackpot. It even sounds like something David Lynch would do. He just wouldn't tell anybody.
My work here is done. Do you know, the reviewers on YouTube that I watched before this and that I have dismissed as, you know, well, I don't know what the word I would use for them because I want to be nice, but it's like, I have dismissed them and I have the true solution. They took hours to explain their theories, and I got it down in, I think, less than 40 minutes.
We did it.
Yes, we did it. Go us. Okay, so this has been another episode of Crackpot Theories. I have been Sinead, and I have been joined by Billy and Ian. Thank you guys so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I hope that you guys are able to actually get some sleep tonight, and you don't just like stay up all night watching Mulholland Drive over and over and over again just to get all the little pieces.
You don't know me well enough.
But this has been another episode of Crackpot Theories, where the truth is out there, and it's a lot weirder than you think. So thank you and good night.
Thank you so much.